listening to Intimacies. If you've been listening for the last couple of episodes, you likely have noticed a bit of forest noise that I like to listen to, well, all the time, when I'm in my room all the time. And I thought that perhaps it would be fantastic as ambient noise for this podcast and to block out any sounds, any naughty sounds of the outside world that I don't want in the background. But now I'm realizing maybe the sound quality is clearer when there is no forest noise. But I'm not sure. So today is an experiment without forest noise. If you are devotedly attached to the forest noise, please write to me and let me know. If you absolutely detest the forest noise, please write to me and let me know that too. But now that we've talked about the forest noise, hello again. Good morning, if it's morning for you. For me, it is indeed morning. It is 9:20 a.m., Tuesday, January 28th. And the last time that we talked, I told you about the fact that I had a date, and I did indeed have that date, but then I had another date last night, and I'm actually not even dating around in this way, meaning it's a bit surprising that I've had two dates in a week, because a couple of years ago I used to go on 100 billion dates and actively searched for love. And then I got, well, deeply discouraged and have definitely flown in and out of discouraged states over the years. And these days, or I guess in the last year, I'd say that my predominant state in relation to dating has been less discouraged of the nihilistic kind and more just recognizing that certain areas of my life will move slower than others, and for reasons that I like to see as spiritual, as connected to God and reincarnation and karma, I really feel that dating for me is meant to move a bit slower, for the sake of time and lessons and hopefully spiritual growth. And, you know, on some days that can actually really dishearten me and leave me a little bit resentful of God even, or just disconnected. But on other days, I can really appreciate this time that I've been given, because I can tell also that in many ways I have a very young soul, and that the last few years it's been a lot of internal transformation and confrontation of myself and kind of bulldozing myself down and reconstructing myself bit to bit. And finally I'm at this stage in the last year where that reconstruction is actually really enjoyable on days when I'm not unbearably lonely. But yeah, when it is really enjoyable, I feel this gratitude for time just for myself, where I don't have to consider the needs of a partner or the needs of children, and can simply learn more about myself and, yeah, I guess I say all this and again recognize that every day is quite different for me, and that I'm a very moody, temperamental creature, and that some days I sit on the train and think, oh my gosh, I don't think I can make it through another mundane day of material reality and disillusion. and fall into a darkness that I used to let myself fall into completely, but these days have coping strategies to deal with. And then other days I feel like I'm on this blissful cloud nine ecstasy of just seeing, really seeing and wholeheartedly feeling the wonder of existence and the small moments, and how there is just as much joy in drinking my Earl Grey tea and eating my breakfast in the morning or going for a walk as there is in passionately falling in love. But yeah, those days are definitely special, and I'd say a bit on, not on the rarer side necessarily, but just they don't also completely negate and make disappear all the difficult feelings, which for me, those come very often. And I definitely had a surge of them after one of these dates that I went on that I'd mentioned last time, where it was, as with, I guess, every date that I go on these days, it was quite confusing. I've been in this period of actively trying to change my pattern when it comes to who I decide to spend time with romantically and invest my care in. And at the same time, I recognize that I'm a very intuitive creature and one who really, really values initial chemistry and just that immediate magic feeling. And I know that these days we all love to talk about infatuation and being in love with the idea of someone. And while I love this, these like discerning critical lenses that we like to put on things, I feel like sometimes when people use that language, it can just kind of reduce the experience or paint it as a lot less real, when in fact the times when I have been struck by that magic feeling and absolutely infatuated with someone, I don't know, I wouldn't say that I was just completely lost in, that I'd completely lost my mind and didn't see reality clearly, and that I was just controlled by lust and all these things. Like, I would actually say that there was a lot of depth and intensity to those feelings, and that even though those fleeting moments of intimacy ended up not leading anywhere and also ended up sometimes really deeply hurting me, there was also something deeply transformative about those feelings. And so, yeah, I guess I'm a little bit protective over initial infatuation and just the nature of crushes, and not reducing crushes, because I think for a lot of people, crushes have been such a large part of their lives, especially for young people, especially for young women in my own circles, where up until recently, and maybe even still now, I would really see my life through this timeline of my crushes, not through like any kinds of milestones when it came to academics or career, and not even that much through place, even though I have moved around and each set of years feels like this new chapter. The timeline of my life would feel very determined and marked by the crushes that I had. Yeah. And I always love thinking about the last big person. And whenever I go through a long period of time without a big person, I can feel really untethered and lackluster, and kind of like I'm playing a waiting game, or that a waiting game is being imposed upon me. Yeah, I'm not sure how I exactly jumped into this. I think I was talking about... Oh, well, I wanted to tell you about the date that I went on, where the reason why it was confusing was because on one hand, throughout the date, I could feel a strong chemistry in terms of our conversation. And on the other hand, I felt very unclear about the, not just the physical attraction, but kind of the chemical and karmic attraction. And I feel like whenever I talk about this, I can hear aloud that I sound a little bit silly, as us women like to oftentimes call ourselves silly, but just because I recognize that you need far more than just one date to build chemistry and to understand and learn how you feel about someone. And I know that for me, that's been my big lesson, how to actually get to know someone and how to build trust and intimacy with someone. And especially when it comes to physical intimacy, where I, for many years, have just jumped into physical intimacy really quickly when I felt that magic feeling. Because firstly, I'm just, well, I'm a lustful, erotically charged and starved girl. And also because regardless of what I was told about intimacy with men growing up and the warnings I heard, I did not really understand what those things meant, and I did not have any kind of protective impulse over myself when it came to physical intimacy until very recently. And that also has been a very painful and slow lesson of understanding that the way that I feel about and approach and am impacted by physical intimacy is not always shared by men, and in fact have not been shared at all with the partners that I've chosen in the past. And something that my therapist, whom I actually absolutely adore, she is one of the loves of my life, and I've gone to therapy since I was 15, 16, and have tried different therapists with different styles. I've done, of course, a lot of just unspecified talk therapy, but I've also done group therapy with like an intensive dialectical behavioral therapy kind of focus, where you follow this workbook and it kind of just feels more like a class where you're learning very concrete skills. And you know, well, okay, I'm really jumping around today, but I guess all these things are interrelated, as all things are. So I'll let myself go on. But you know, growing up and in the last few years, I always had a very positive outlook when it came to therapy, of really encouraging other people to get into therapy if they never have, and to prioritize that kind of not just like looking out for yourself, but also active work on yourself. And I still feel this way very much, but I've also, in the last couple of years, I've gained a new perhaps a new awareness or a new critical eye when it comes to what kind of therapy you go into and the therapist you're seeing, and I guess just a recognition that right now, especially in this Western world, there is a really big emphasis placed on the treatment of mental health through psychotherapy and medication. And on one hand, I, of course, as someone who has many times been very mentally ill and needed those resources, I really believe in those things. But I also, I guess from my own experiences and from experiences of people close to me, I have seen how certain relationships with certain therapists can really open up those windows for growth, and certain relationships can actually keep you in cycles that are obstructing your growth, and that there are even certain therapists that might invite in subtle harm in terms of the way you think you should be dealing with your problems or experiences or worries. And I guess what makes me say that, part of it is, and again, I'm very grateful to every therapist I've had, because I think those relationships, like any, came in a particular time of my life and in a time when maybe I needed those relationships, and now realize I need different kinds of relationships. But for a long while, therapy for me was very much like a talking space. And on one hand, especially when I was in high school, that was very much a lifeline for me, because in high school I was pretty unbearably lonely without really recognizing that. And so when I was put into therapy, because I was at a boarding school, and they learned of my self-harming behaviors, so I was put into the therapy room. I think what I needed most then was not even any kind of diagnosis, not medication, but just a friend and just space to be myself and explore myself and share what was going on in my head and talk about all the schemes about boys that I had. Yeah, and when I got to college, that's when I took a break from therapy. Then I started looking again, and at that point when I was looking, it felt like a far more urgent or dire moment, because while in high school I was in this institution and very much in this bubble with structure and accountability to it, once I left high school, that wasn't the case at all. And of course, at university, you can find those resources, you can find those structures, but I think in terms of accountability, it's very different, because you're also far more on your own. And you know, likely nobody will put you into therapy unless things are really dire. It's more something that you have to take control of yourself. And part of why I felt that I needed to was because I was going through really intense mood swings multiple times a day, and a lot of hopelessness and a lot of passive but definitely potent suicidal ideation. And I think I've talked about this, a lot of these feelings, in the earlier episodes, about the fact that, again, from like 15 until a year or two ago, my mental health and just my inner world have been really murky for me and very fraught. And so then when I finally found a therapist, that was, I didn't really know what I needed. I just knew I needed to see someone. And at that point also, I actually thought that what I needed was a diagnosis and something that I thought that I likely would be diagnosed with, which I somewhat did later on, with borderline personality disorder, which also I feel like these days is very easily reached for by people in their own heads in terms of wondering if they have that, especially young women. And when it comes to diagnoses, also on one hand, I think they can be really, really affirming of experiences that make you feel like you might be crazy or untreatable, or especially affirming when you yourself are denying the fact that you're suffering. And then on the other hand, I think diagnoses can also be very limiting and can lead you to see yourself through a very limited frame point. And there are also, I think, many times when people are misdiagnosed. And so again, I think it's just always something that's great to look at through a critical eye, as with, I guess, everything. And so at that point, I got more of just a talk therapist who I think likely was using cognitive behavioral therapy outlooks, but her style and structure were pretty loosey-goosey, and it was really just talking. And I also, that was when I had gotten into my first really difficult relationship, romantic relationship, that was fairly emotionally abusive, and a lot of my time in therapy we would spend just talking about that, because it was just a lot of kind of emergency fire drills in terms of every week there would be fights to talk about and like feelings to process in that space. And then finally when I got out of that relationship but continued with therapy, that's when I realized I didn't always know what to talk about, because suddenly there were none of these explicit fire drills happening day to day. And so in terms of knowing where to start with and what needs addressing, that felt pretty unclear to me. And I also questioned whether I should even be in therapy, if in fact I'm fine or functioning fine, which is also a very relative thing. And I feel like we all these days like to say that we're fine when a lot of the time we are not fine at all. But I have digressed so much. I guess I was talking about, I don't know, let's finish this point. In terms of therapy, having a therapist with whom I would primarily just talk and intellectualize my feelings with, eventually we hit a standstill where I felt that I was going in every week and talking about things, but that nothing was changing, and that a lot of the feelings, or perhaps all of the feelings, were still very much there and were still very isolating and crushing, and things I did not know how to alleviate. And on one hand, when I did the dialectical behavioral therapy intensive, that was really transformative for me, because that is the kind of therapy that really teaches you hands-on concrete skills that you can reach for within your everyday life. And once you practice them and kind of ingrain them into your system, then you start to rely on a therapist far less. But all of this, basically, this dialectical behavioral therapy, this cognitive talk therapy that I'd done for many years, I finally got perspective about how that was not exactly what I've been needing. Where in the past year I got a new therapist, and she's someone who works specifically with the body, a somatic therapist, you could say, and has many years of experience, as well as has done a lot of research specifically on trauma and the body. And it was just a completely new way of relating to a therapist for me, our relationship, because firstly, out of all these years of having gone to so much therapy, I realized that I'd never really talked about my feelings within the context of my body and how they actually feel within my body, where I knew there was this anxiety, but what was such a standstill for me with my past therapist was that I never knew how to talk about anxiety, because for me, anxiety, it's far more of a deeply sensorial feeling rather than explicit thoughts running through my head. Where of course I think there are always kind of more unconscious thoughts that come along with my anxiety, but I have gained a lot of awareness about how on a daily basis I struggle with anxiety, in the sense that there is so much of the time this weight or pressure or tightness and intensity in my chest, and that makes it very difficult to breathe, and that can make me feel really exhausted by the end of the day, even if I've done comparatively little. And so part of this awareness that I've gained, that's very much the kind of work that I do with this therapist, where firstly it's about I guess increasing your ability to recognize sensations and to be able to observe them and describe them from a non-judgmental place, and not trying to attach any kind of intellectualized, therapized narrative to why you might be feeling an emotion, but instead just sitting with it and letting your mind describe the actual sensation, the color, the texture, the size of this emotion, whether it's softer or sharper. And this kind of describing technique, it pretty much gives your mind, your thinking mind that always wants to be doing something to do, so that instead of attaching some kind of intellectualized narrative of why you might be feeling this way, instead the thinking mind can just slow down and describe this feeling and let it stay there without trying to make it go away by figuring out its root. And yeah, that's just been so instrumental for me in navigating myself and my day-to-day, and also seeing myself as far more of a human being and an animal, rather than, I guess, kind of like a mentally disordered, psychotherapized basket case, which I think it was easy to kind of internalize that over the years, as someone who had been in therapy for a while and went through such highs and lows. And part of that, I think, is also because in certain therapy spaces, I've really felt the sterility of those relationships far more than the intimacy, where I think, and this is something I've been thinking about in general in my life, and partially because I've been learning about tarot slowly, and one of the tarot cards that keeps coming up for me is the Six of Pentacles, which is very much about power and the balances or imbalances of it, and hierarchies and giving, the energy flows of giving and receiving. Again, I'm also still very much learning, so please be merciful with me if you are a tarot expert and think I'm saying nonsense. But what I was saying was that I've been thinking about power and intimacy, especially within the context of therapist and client relationship, where I feel like right now, especially in this Western world, we have this idea that a therapist ought to be this blank space, and that whenever a therapist brings things in from their own life, that if anything, that's more inappropriate rather than helpful, or that that there has to be some kind of like sterile line between a therapist and a client. And I guess what I've learned with this new therapist in the last year is that part of what makes our contact so nourishing and transformative for me and lasting is the fact that there's so much warmth and so much love and so much goofiness and play, and that just as vulnerable as I am, she also offers me vulnerability in terms of like offering real life examples from her own life. And that's just been so cool, because to meet with a therapist whom I like these days see more like just someone that I really admire and really trust, rather than this like medical professional who's supposed to fix me, firstly, it just gets me really excited about our sessions. I just feel so much love and light when we talk. And secondly, it's also, again, helped me see myself differently and see myself less as like a peculiarity when it comes to psychic well-being, and more so just a part of, or an expression of, the human experience, and that a lot of these feelings that I struggle with are actually very natural and organic to the body, and that allowing yourself to recognize it and just tend to your body and allowing your feelings to be there, that is actually what allows them to flow and change and alleviate. And I'd love to just do a whole episode where I just talk about that, because I'm really quite fascinated by it, and I would love to do more research on my own too and offer more knowledge too, rather than just my own blah blah blah. But I got so carried away and distracted, because what I was wanting to talk about was my date, because yes, I went on a date, and it was confusing because our conversation on one hand was really, really interesting, where he also grew up moving around and loves self-help books, so clearly we had some kind of intersecting interests where I actually don't really like self-help books, but I clearly love to talk about subjects related to spirituality and growth and the body and the mind. And he was just a really fantastic question asker. I feel like, especially when I was younger, I would carry a lot of the weight in terms of asking questions on dates and kind of investing a lot more inquisitiveness into the other person than I might have always felt. Whereas now I try to let go of control more and offer more space to also be asked questions. And sometimes people rise to the occasion and sometimes people do not. But he very much did. He was a very good question asker. But the reason why it was confusing was because as much as I felt this line of chemistry, I didn't feel that strong physical karmic draw, which also, like, objectively, he was a very handsome man, but whenever this happens, I always find it really confusing because I don't know how much of it is my intuition and something I should just immediately trust, and how much of it is more just a natural curve that I have to lean into in terms of letting things slow burn and letting my attraction rise. And I think on one hand, a lesson I keep learning is that when I don't feel attraction, it's probably better to just leave things be, because again, I'm somewhat of a erotically starved, lustful, charged girl, and when I am attracted to someone, I feel it very clearly. And so when I don't, it's very difficult for me to grow into those feelings. But then on the other hand, I also know that has been a part of why intimacy has not gone the way that I have always hoped. Something that I wanted to mention earlier but then got distracted was how in therapy, oh yes, I think this was the whole diving board for the therapy ramble, but in therapy, my lovely therapist, she's talked about how sex, the choice to have sex, the one way to think about it is that instead of having sex to try to make a connection, one should try to have sex to celebrate a connection. And I think likely for some this sounds pretty obvious, and perhaps like the way they always related to sex, which if so, that's fabulous. But for me, when she first said that, I was really struck by that choice of words, and it was interesting to me because I think people's suggestions about how one should or should not have sex can easily inspire or provoke shame and a sense that you're just like a gross wrong slut for doing things the way that you do, and that it's never going to work out if that's how you do it. But the way that she framed it just made it far more clear to me that it's not about social constructs, it's not about how the other person will see me, whether they'll see me more as more disposable or not. It's actually just far more about myself and like my relationship to intimacy and safety and joy, and that each time I have sex from the get-go and try to make this connection, it's coming far more from a place, well, on one hand, again, overexcitement, but also from a place of fear rather than a place of joy. Whereas having sex to celebrate a connection, that sounds so fantastic to, I guess, recognize that there is something special between you and someone, and wanting to throw a little physical party to kind of acknowledge that. And yeah, when I think about my relationship to sex throughout my coming of age, I can definitely get quite sad. And on one hand, I really appreciate the sadness because I can tell there's more self-compassion for myself, for my younger self now than in the past. And I also get curious about like where exactly did I inherit, where did I inherit these behaviors or ideas from, in terms of really having this sense that in order to connect with a man, I must have sex with him, and that is the gateway to love, and that also if I'm put in a potentially sexual situation with men that I must deliver and, in fact, have the sex instead of evaluating how I feel and whether I actually want to or not. And, yeah, all that definitely makes me a bit sad because I now see that for a long time, or all the time that I was having sex until literally like the last year of having finally taken a break, that I've been very sad and suffering and refusing to acknowledge my own suffering. And yeah, I guess these days I really do want to have sex from this place of celebrating my connection with someone and celebrating the fact that I feel safe and treasured and seen by them. Which, you know, is also tricky because, for example, the last big person for me was someone whom I met in early October, and we saw each other for around a month, and it was the first time actually in pretty much like since my last relationship, which was already 3 years ago, that I felt, oh wow, maybe this is the start of a relationship. And it was definitely a bummer because I felt myself really trying to take things slow and trying to pace myself and not attach any expectations. But I guess when the hope rises, it's very hard to kill. And I really had this hope that our getting to know each other was us beginning a relationship. And I got excited from the beginning, and I did have sex from the beginning, from the second date. And at first I definitely felt panic about that decision, but then also my therapist reminded me how the reason why I might have panic about that is because of these ideas that sometimes I believe in terms of that, well, that if I have sex immediately, that I kind of like reduce my value or like give a man what he wants and now he will no longer be interested in me. And part of that I think is from culturally inherited ideas. Part of that is from my own painful experiences in terms of sharing myself physically really soon and being left soon after. But she made me realize that this rule that sometimes I really feel and yet still break, that it's not my rule at all. It's someone else's rule, and it's kind of this baggage that I carry around and can flare up in me when I get scared and when I feel like, oh no, maybe I've broken this rule. But it is not my rule. So if I break it, I don't care because that is not my rule. Where I think it's perfectly okay and perfectly incredible also to you know, feel that charge with someone from the beginning and yeah, like explore physical intimacy from the start. And then at the same time, I also recognize that I am a very sensitive person in love and when it comes to sex, because I am a sensitive person in general, but also because I've had a lot of wounding in those areas. And so taking it slower is not something that I should do, because that's how you get into a relationship, because that's how, you know, proper ladies do it or whatever. But it's more, or it's completely something that I these days try out of intimacy with myself and out of understanding of myself and knowing that there is a small child in me for whom these areas of life are really intimidating and easily painful. And so slowing things down, yeah, it's not at all that's something that should be determined by the outsider, the man in question or the whomever in question, but instead just deep contact with myself. And where was I? I guess I was talking about, oh yes, my date. That didn't go very well. But now I think we're still going on a second date. It was confusing. What ended up happening was I had asked during our date if we should go on a second date. Or I guess his feelings about this first date, because whether this is a good way to approach things or not, I, especially these days, am incredibly direct, and I like to know whether I'm seeing someone or not by the end of the first date, and I like to be upfront with whether I feel a connection or not, because I think it saves a lot of time and energy and allows the contact to feel truthful, which I think, well, I really value, because it's, on dates it's easy also to find a lack of truth, unfortunately. But I had asked him his feelings, and he told me he does feel chemistry and he would like to, and then I told him that on one hand I feel chemistry and on the other hand I'm confused because I don't feel the magic feeling, and then voiced my own confusion about myself that I voiced here. And yeah, he's a very thoughtful person, so it was great to air those things out. But what ended up happening was that I naturally discouraged him, I think, and he felt like if there's no magic feeling, that it would be a waste of both of our time, and that he's been in relationships where there were a lot of great things, but there was no magic feeling, and that those relationships ended, and so he also really does believe in the magic feeling. And all of it was so deflating in a way that I did not expect, because, you know, I've been on a bajillion dates, and I've experienced disappointment in a bajillion ways on dates, and these days I feel like I, again, have many tools to help me throughout my own disappointment. And it was confusing to know, to even to see what I was disappointed about. Because on one hand, I was not sure about my connection with this person, so it wasn't necessarily that I felt rejected. It was more that, I think, so on one hand, when it comes to dates and talking about just the concept of dates and what you want and romantic pasts and just your whole relationship with dating, I love those conversations, because I just, as a person, in my relationship to art, literature, I just love thinking about this realm. But on the other hand, there's a part of me that really doesn't like it, because it can make dates feel a little bit overly, or yeah, I guess it can just make things feel a bit sterile, especially when there's no romantic feeling. It feels a bit too analytical and like you're drilling into something, and that instead of like feeling things out, you're just like talking and thinking about them. And again, I'm confused, because I also know that I really value communication, and that I also just need communication, or else I freak out. But yeah, I think that was partially why I felt really deflated. And even though I took care of myself that night, and I took a car home, and I made sure I ate and went to bed, the feeling of discouragement that I felt was so heavy, to a really surprising degree. And partially, I think it could have also been the influence of the moon. I'm very sensitive to the positions of the moon, and that night the moon was in Scorpio, which can be, in fact, a very difficult placement. So perhaps that was partially it. I was also tired, and I hadn't eaten dinner, so I was hungry, and as I've learned in many years of therapy, all those factors can make a really big difference in how I feel and receive things. But yeah, so the conclusion was that we are gonna go on a second date, because then the next day he actually messaged me and kind of brought up how maybe we could be good opportunities for growth, and that we can just take things a date at a time. So he invited me to do some exquisite corpse painting together, which I didn't really know what that involves, but I guess it is like a creative game where we both paint a half of something and then put it together, which is definitely a curious activity. Yeah, and I've been going back and forth about whether a second date would be fruitful or not. And for now, I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess I'm not sure. And I think we're kind of running low on time, so I want to wrap things up. And I actually really wanted to talk about the second date that I went on, because the second date, it came out of the blue. It's the first time in a long time that someone had asked me out in person. And yeah, I'm having a lot of thoughts about it, because it had gone really well, and then we hit this impasse and everything really changed and somewhat collapsed, because we learned that we have political differences, one could say. I don't really love that term. But yeah, it was just, the whole thing was surprising, because the fact that I had enjoyed the date had surprised me, then the fact that this new information I learned was surprising, and then the fact that I felt such a strong reaction in terms of this being a potential deal breaker, that had somewhat surprised me too. And now I'm kind of pondering whether it is a deal breaker, or like, what do I need from this person in order for it to not be a deal breaker, and in order for myself to feel encouraged in terms of further getting to know each other. And yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on it, so I would love to talk about it next time, and who knows, maybe I'll never hear from him again. But anyways, you'll hear the story regardless of what happens. And yeah, I think this is all I have to say for today. I was going to read this lovely, you know, I think I have time. Yeah, I have time. So I got this book, this beautiful book called The Overview: Meditations on Nature for a World in Transition by Willow Defebole. And it is from Atmos. Atmos, it's a nonprofit media platform that I believe is particularly devoted to the intersection between art and climate. So yeah, I think a lot of the things that they publish are from artists and scientists and activists, and I'm really curious about their other publications. But this, firstly, the cover just struck me because it's beautiful. It's kind of like a canvasy hard cover, and it's like big coffee table size. And on the front, there's this beautiful pink flower. I don't know what kind of flower, but all of it naturally immediately grabbed my attention, and I have skimmed a little bit. It's definitely a book that I just want to spend a lot of slow time on here and there, where there's beautiful photography. All of the photography involving elements of nature, and that there's like really close-up kind of erotic shots of the insides of clementines, or kind of like just these really dramatic shots of waves, or these naked bodies amongst nature and cows. And yeah, it's just really, really beautiful photography. A lot of it is very soft and almost ethereal, and yeah, just really connects to the part of my soul that adores. Oh god, I hope that was not too disturbing. I hit the microphone with the cover of the book in my attempts to move it so I can read it. Where today I just want to read the introduction. And I'm usually not someone who even reads introductions to everything, but today I decided I will for this book, and I just really love the language that Willow de Febeau uses. I believe her pronouns are she, her. Please have mercy with me if they're not. But yeah, it's just, I think maybe I mentioned it last time, or maybe you can just pick up on it from my the subjects I've been talking about, but I've been thinking a lot about spirituality in the last year, and our relationships with God and energy and the rest of the natural world, and the fires in California recently, for example. That was something that was leaving a lot of despair in me, where I didn't grow up in Los Angeles, I don't even know many people out there, and so I can't imagine how heartbreaking it was for people with a close tie to the city. But it was just really devastating, and I have never seen science as my strong suit, but recently I've been more and more interested in, I guess, ecology and learning more about the natural world and about the climate, and especially learning about the dire issues from sources that somehow offer or investigate potential solutions, or are able to offer some kind of light while delivering this knowledge, even if it's just the light of the energy of the person sharing. For example, I've been listening to this podcast by the BBC called, you know, I forgot what it's called. I think it's called Climate Solutions or Climate Change. No, probably Climate Solutions. And every episode they explore a different question. Oh, maybe it's called Climate Question. Yes, I think it's the Climate Question. But I really recommend it, where I love the host. I think she has a really inviting, beautiful energy, and they just make each episode really, really compelling and fascinating, where, again, I'm not someone who has ever been comfortable in the world of science, but I just find the topics they explore really interesting, and it makes me feel like I'm getting some kind of dose of you know, being present with what's going on in the world and seeing reality as it is, while also consuming it in a way that doesn't absolutely dishearten me and makes me not want to leave my bed. Yeah, so I really recommend The Climate Question from BBC. And then I want to just read this introduction written by Willow de Febeau. Yeah, okay. For as long as I can remember, nature has been my church, the song of every cicada a sermon, the shade of every poplar, a pew. Studying ecosystems puts my problems into perspective. I'm reminded of the vast interrelatedness of existence, of which I'm but one small part. I believe that every aspect of the flowering tree of life carries a teaching for us. That's how this book of essays that you are now holding came to be. What began as a weekly newsletter turned into a devotional practice, seeking guidance from nature on how to navigate the messy experience of being human. It's also how I came to better understand deep ecology, also called spiritual ecology. It's an eco-philosophy that weaves together science and spirituality, despite how ingrained it is in many of us that these should be separated, that these should be separate. The phrase was introduced to Western cultures in 1972 by Norwegian philosopher Arne Naes, but indigenous peoples have been practicing it for much longer. And while Naes created his own pillars of deep ecology, it has since evolved to take many forms. This book is organized by what I consider to be its core principles. For me, the foundation of deep ecology, and our first chapter, is about cultivating a sense of reverence, a word that perfectly bridges the divide between science and spirituality. Similar yet distinct from wonder, emotions researcher Brené Brown describes reverence as a deeper form of admiration or respect that is often combined with a sense of meaningful connection with something greater than ourselves. This is why I focus on a different, awe-inspiring aspect of nature in each essay. I believe illuminating the many marvels of our world is the most effective way to motivate people to act on its behalf. In familiarizing ourselves with earthly phenomena, we begin to understand how connected everything is. But a web is more than any individual strand. It's also the balance they create, the focus of our second chapter. Ecosystems are dependent upon such delicate harmonies in order to thrive. This is why a core principle of deep ecology is a biocentric worldview rather than an anthropocentric one, understanding that all human and non-human life is of equal importance. In re-examining the threads that connect all of us in the web of life, we are reminded of our greatest tool in repatterning them, each other. We can understand these concepts, but what does it matter if we aren't putting them into action? We must be committed to our own evolution, which forms the third chapter. While those in power cling to the past, nature is an engine of change, teaching that anything that doesn't adapt will eventually perish. All of life is in transition, matter in metamorphosis, especially in the era of the climate crisis. It is on each of us to decide what we are turning into. Scattered across these pages is my own transition, which has taught me that change is not only possible, but beautiful. The final chapter speaks most directly to the ultimate aspiration of deep ecology, and the environmental movement is at large. Healing. On the surface, we must mend the damage that colonization, corporate greed, government complicity, and decades-long public apathy have authored on this planet. And yet, these are all symptoms of a deeper wound, the separation between humans and nature. It's only by sowing that divide that we will begin to truly remedy our relationships with ourselves, each other, and the rest of life on Earth. Changing our world will require us to change our worldview, which is to say, our spiritual outlook. By cultivating reverence, balance, evolution, and healing, I believe that we can alter the trajectory our species is currently on and lead fulfilling lives along the way. What I'm proposing here is by no means revolutionary. Spirituality serves an important role in shaping our individual and societal lives. I've simply chosen to center mine around science. After all, if science is the study of life and spirituality is the study of the sacred, why shouldn't they be one and the same? Yeah, I love it. Like, I love her diction, the flow of her sentences, and I especially find it really moving how this book, it's called Meditations on Nature for a World in Transition, and how she's thinking about these ideas of wonder and evolution, and coming from a very personal place of being trans, and I guess applying that, or not apply, like really sitting with that personal experience to gain an even more expansive worldview and an expansive view when it comes to spirituality and our relationship to nature and science. And yeah, I think, I don't know, I'm also just oftentimes very in awe of trans writers and artists, and I just find her, I find this deep spending time with oneself and like encouragement of change towards authenticity and uncertainty. I find that really exciting, and I find it really admirable, and it's something that I hope for everybody. And yeah, I think I love the courage. But that's it for today. We kind of jumped around from date to therapies to ecology. And I hope that one thing or another was hopefully in some way nourishing. And I hope that today is just a fantastic day, that you allow yourself to take things slow and to rest and eat delicious things. And thank you so much for listening. My name is Daria Alara, and you've been listening to Intimacies.